Welcome to Dance Pod with Skånes Dansteater, a podcast brought to you by Sweden's largest independent dance institution. Your chance to hear from dance artists, engage with movement, and delve deeper into our creative process.
Hi everyone, my name is Sam and I'm a dancer here with Skånes Dansteater. In today's episode, I'm going to be talking to Heidi Viethala, a highly sought-after choreographer and teacher of the Streamflow movement method. Heidi comes from Seattle in the United States and is currently based in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Now, as a dancer, Heidi has had a hugely successful and extensive performance career with some of the most prominent dance companies and choreographers in Europe and the United States, including the Forsyth Company, Gothenburg Ballet, now known as Göteborg Operans Dance Company, Ballet Frankfurt, Ballet Dortmund, Tanzwerk, Nuremberg, Ballet Chicago, and Pacific Northwest Ballet. It's a long list indeed. Since retiring in 2006 from her performance career, Heidi has established an equally active and creative career that encompasses many influences and experiences from working as a dancer. Nowadays, she's primarily working as a freelance choreographer and teacher in professional dance companies and universities around the world. More specifically, Heidi has developed and continues to develop the Streamflow movement method, which forms the starting point of all her teaching and choreographic work. She creates work for both companies and schools, and under her own creative initiative, the Hato Project, based in Amsterdam. We're very lucky that Heidi regularly comes to teach and share Streamflow with us here at Skånes Dansteater. Now, towards the end of the episode, Heidi will kindly share with us a guided Streamflow movement exploration that uses visual imagery and tactile exercises to get you moving your own bodies. I hope you enjoy listening. Heidi, welcome to Dance Pod with Skånes Dansteater.
Thank you. Such an honor to be here.
It's a total blessing to have you here. So thanks for taking the time to chat with me.
Of course.
Actually, since me and Kit have started this podcast series, we always had you penned down as a bit of a bucket list episode.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm really happy that we managed to find the time to do it. So I just gave a very brief introduction about you, but I don't think it really serves justice for the kind of remarkable artistic career that you've had. So I just want to start off briefly for listeners that don't know who you are, in your own words, in just a few sentences, could you just introduce yourself?
Yeah, well, I thought the introduction was actually quite overwhelming. Thank you. I mean, yeah, so just a quick introduction. Yes, you said most of it. Now, I was born and raised in the United States, and I have a German passport, German father, Austrian mother, and now I've been in Europe for 24 years already, which goes by quickly. So I'm now based in Amsterdam, and since my son was born, like you said, in 2006, I've been developing my own work and sort of digesting my career a bit and teaching, choreographing, and working with multidisciplinary projects.
Nice.
And, yeah. So
I want to start by focusing on where you are right now, because I think as we begin to talk, we'll sift through and go backwards.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know, like, artistically where you see yourself today. Like, how would you categorize your work or your approach today? So where are you at right now?
Oh, yeah. Right now I'm kind of in a whirlwind of things, I think. Of course, because of this time, you know, it's also like, it sort of feels surreal in a way. I am right now still developing Streamflow method daily. It seems like with every company or school I encounter, it keeps growing because I get the information from the dancers that I'm sharing the space with. So that is, like you said, also always the starting point for my work. And I am so lucky to be able to use that to also now really embark on some choreographic projects that are working with other artists. So I've been working now with a textile designer getting ready for a project in Borås for Regionstheater. So that's nice. So it sort of feels like things are at a point of coming together.
Yeah.
So it's like the you know, bringing the stream flow in as a starting point for the work, which is very functional movement, and how that works together with other artists is really sort of a dream come true. And then on the other side, I have the work at the University in Amsterdam with Expanded Contemporary Dance, which is a new department that's just been developed. So I was on the core team of developing that. And so that's nice to see how that's coming to life. And now we have the second year of new students. So I'm very busy with that and teaching companies internationally and then my own work. So I'm at a place that makes me really happy, actually, because it's been years of developing.
Yeah.
And figuring out what is important to me and how I can translate the information to different organizations, companies, dancers, students, or non-dancers as well.
I mean, it feels like you're juggling lots of different tasks, I would say, but at the same time, each thing seems to be informing.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, well said. I mean, that is what I'm realizing now. It's like, you come to the point where you just feel like, it's taking so long in a way. But then it's like, I guess my whole career has been kind of, I've always been sort of a late bloomer. So now I feel like, and it's, things are, starting to fall in place. So that's nice.
So you just mentioned stream flow.
Yeah.
And so you're here with us here in Malmo. You're in the middle of 2 weeks. You're teaching us morning class and sharing your stream flow movement method. So why don't we just start there? So where did stream flow begin for you?
Wow. It's always difficult when I think about where it actually came from. I keep going back and back and back. So just stop me if I'm going on too long.
Carry on.
But I realized, I had the whole ballet career at Pacific Northwest Ballet and then Ballet Chicago. And then I had a car accident, which forced me to stop. I went back home to Seattle and I ran into a former dancer of the company, Magali Mesek, and she was a gyrotonics instructor, and she had her own studio in Seattle, and she offered me a scholarship to come twice a week, sort of as a form of rehabilitation. So I started working with that movement method, so the gyrotonics movement method developed by Julia Horvath, and I started to realize that after all those years of training in ballet, I still really didn't understand my body. I didn't, it was sort of approaching the movement from the outside. And it was the first time I started to really think of different connections, different parts leading the body. So it was also very functional. So when you have the resistance of the wheels or the straps that you're in that have a resistance, so it really allows you to take the time to connect with deeper points of initiation. So that was something that I never really connected to stream flow, but I realized that really sparked my interest in working in that way of dividing the body in sections and thinking about where things are coming from. So that's where I think that's the starting point. And then coming to Europe and working with more modern companies, of course, that work influenced me as well. So, starting working with in Nuremberg with Jacopo Godani. It was also with the Foresight. It was working with Ballet Frankfurt. It was Ballet Frankfurt at the time. And then we did some of Bill's work and then worked with Rui Horta. And everything was, for me, was just such a joy of like, I felt like it was sort of honest movement, mm-hmm. of like I could really think about where things were coming from. I was more grounded. And it just kept informing my body and giving it more information. So then eventually, traveling through the different companies, I feel so fortunate to have done that, working with OHAD and working with Bill, with William Forsythe and all of that. And, experiencing the Gaga, first of all, was wonderful because I had never done anything like it. So, and also working with Mari, who was OHAD's wife at the time. And I don't know. Just working with her did something to me that also made me feel more grounded. And then through the Gaga, it was also a lot of visuals and bringing sensations into the body. And there was just one idea that he talked about the ball rolling in between the shoulder space. So somehow that created a lot of movement in my body and got the tension out of my shoulders. And I always had a lot of tension there. And then after that, I went on to dance with with William Forsythe. And so all of the information I got from him was just, I mean, mind-blowing. And the environment, the exploration, the laboratories that we were in, it's just like, I was like, am I getting paid for this? It's just like, you've got to be kidding me, you know? It's just like hours to explore and just to be triggered by him and for him to sort of point out our habits. And of course, it wasn't all fun. It's painful when you realize, you know, you're keep doing the same thing over and over. So it was constantly reinventing myself and reinventing my way of moving and exploring my way of moving. So, I mean, I could go on for hours about how Bill influenced the work that I do now and how I'm so grateful for everyone I've worked with. So finishing my dancing career with Forsythe, and then having a child, and then taking time to digest the information, I started teaching. So teaching also informed me in my body, because I had to work with so many different dancers. With you know, everybody has a different anatomical makeup, so you have to really think about how they can connect to their bodies with certain limitations or so. I mean, that was my biggest education, I think. I mean, so taking the information I had, which I was digesting while I was teaching. So the combination of that, I don't know if I'm getting a little bit off track here, but
no. But I mean, so I think what we can say from that is that you've spoken very eloquently about some of the influences that have informed StreamFlow. So you talk about gyrotonics and your career with William Forsythe, and you talk about Gaga. I think we'll get to talking about Akito Hino as well.
Yes, also. I mean, there's so much there. So
if someone was to come and take a StreamFlow movement class, like for someone that's not done that before, I mean, what can they expect to do in it, or what can they expect to take from it?
Well, so I work with a lot of imagery. So then I can sort of go back to the idea that I took from Ohad, in the sense of just the ball rolling. And then I had met a friend who was a psychologist, and she gave me this book called Awakening Intuition by Francis Vaughan, his name. And he talks about, there was just a list of all these. It was like the space between your eyes, space between your ears, space between the chin and the neck, and the space between the shoulders. And I just thought, wait a minute, why don't I, you know, start just working section by section? You know, so separating the body rather than doing a whole body experience, but just getting in tune with your body section by section. So after Bill had once pointed out that he, I had to show a solo one day for the company when I first joined, and I was completely nervous. And so I made the solo with all these dancers I've been looking up to for years. Show this, and I did it, and he stopped me, and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I am doing my solo." And he goes, "Well," I said, "are you trying to be Forsythe?" And I said, "Well, I guess so." That's why, I guess I'm, you know, sort of new here, so I'm trying to pick up on things. And he said, "I don't think you know where the movement is coming from in your body." Okay. So that rocked my world. So that made me go into the investigation. Yeah. So anyway, so that brings us back to your question of what would should people expect when they take the class. So I will talk you through these visualizations that go through all the sections of the body. So eye to eye, ear to ear. And I use the image of a ball rolling, or you can think of water streaming in between the spaces. And then I talk about, well, I took Kit now through the warm-up. And you can try it at home as well. So I just realized that when making movement, I was always leading with the same parts of the body, and that going through section by section, I could sort of tap into parts, and it would take me to unpredictable places and help me develop movement in that way. So I was like, wow, it's so worth it to spend time and a bit of rigor and to really take yourself in beyond those frustrating movements, you know, moments, to see where you can actually land or embark from. So
it's like what resonates for me when you say that is it's also a space where you can break down habitual patterns in your body, because you're opening up new pathways. And
yes, definitely. So, and that was for me also to realize where I have a lot of tension in the body, what part have I never thought of initiating with, whether it be, you know, the throat or the ear or from under the armpit or, you know, certain things. And it's sort of, yeah, the body follows through. And then instead of trying to make complex movement, following a simple idea sort of creates that complexity in the body. And I was like, wow, it's much easier than I thought, in a sense. Yeah. You know? So,
and am I right in thinking that you have a very, like you're interested in discovering a deeper knowledge of the body's possibilities?
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
It's like a never-ending thing. And I can't believe even at my age now, I'm just like, it never stops informing me. And those, the people that are in the studio and exchanging with me, and I just see it, just, it keeps informing me. So it's like such a joy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for me, it feels like you're in a constant state of observation.
Yeah,
when you're teaching. One of the rewarding things about taking your classes is that it's not in a forceful way, but you kind of gently guide or propose a question, and because you're moving continuously and you're going through a state of practice, you're kind of reminded of things, or you think, oh God, I didn't think of that. And then you have something to go with or something to respond to.
Oh, that's nice to hear. Yeah. And I think also it's like not the pressure to have to worry about what things look like. We have so much pressure, and it's sort of like the quality that comes out of just more putting the importance on what things feel like, or taking the moment to find the spot that you want to initiate with, just gives such a quality to the movement. And I think the audience can see that, and they can see the difference of someone who's in the moment and in their body and taking the time to find that. And so it is...
It's quite a difficult thing to describe, isn't it? Because I think as performers, reaching that kind of state of awareness, or those very rare moments on stage when you are in a place where you're so connected, it's such a difficult thing to describe.
Yeah.
But we know when it's happening inside
of us. We take it for granted, don't we, in a way? Because we're already at a certain level of body awareness, and it just keeps going deeper and deeper. But that thing of just letting go of worrying, I mean, and of course, yeah, it depends how rigorous you are about it now, or how, the more you research it, the deeper you can go into it, so you don't even need to think about it anymore.
Yeah.
And that's the thing I realized the more I do it. Like this last week, I've been doing, I don't know, so many classes in a week, a weekend workshop, and I just feel like, wow, you know, it feels... I feel like it's a meditation in a way. It's a moving body scan, and it gives peace.
Yeah, and also
during these times.
Yeah, and also it's very much it's a shared experience that we're having all together as well, which is also a really beautiful thing.
Yeah. I love that. I see people, it's sort of feeling the energies now around the room, and it's sort of... Yeah, I don't need to. I'll just suggest things, but you guys are busy finding your own thing. So I hope that it creates that empowering atmosphere, you know, in a sense that people can feel free to bring in their own ideas.
Yeah, I like what you say about empowerment, because it feels like you're also trying to, you're using stream flow as a way of accessing the individual in front of you. So, like, I'm curious, why is that important to you?
Ah, because everybody comes with their own history, and that is beautiful. And then it's just sort of keep bringing in information. This is something that Bill would say a lot, Forsyth. He would say that be open to everything, and like bringing in, you know, being open to everything in all forms of movement and what other experiences you have, even outside of dance, it makes the body more intelligent, you know. So I keep thinking, it's like, wow, just keep adding knowledge to what you already have and playing with that and see how it might shift it a bit. So, everybody has their own training or how they experience things, or
when you talk about stream flow, you describe it as being a creative way of bridging together different forms of dance, and also what we've said before, but breaking habits in the body. What do you mean by bridging together different forms of dance?
I think it brings you back to the functional body. So you pass through the functional body to these different techniques and forms. So I always think about my own training and about how I had the ballet. You know, and how, I mean, you grew up with that as well, didn't you?
A little bit. I actually only started ballet when I was 16.
Oh my God.
I was doing more the I came actually back from gymnastics was my thing.
Oh, wow. That but that my... also informs exactly. the body. That's also functional, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
I mean, and that's also very interesting. So I, you know, I think back and think, my God, what if I would have known my body better? Yeah. There was no somatic warm up before ballet. There was no way of getting in touch with it. The closest I got to that ever was like going out dancing, you know,
yeah.
where I could let go and just enjoy, yeah. you know, my body moving in a certain way. So I was always craving to, do something different. But no, I feel that getting back, so getting into the functional body, you can use just talk to your body.
I remember you talking about just the simplicity of lifting an arm and there being so many different individual beautiful ways of doing it. And it's not necessarily, you talk a lot about how you approach a movement. Mm-hmm. You don't talk about just executing the movement and seeing it as a clear form. It's how you get there.
Yeah. And I think that comes from, for years, I was just thinking I have like an arm, you know, it's like, and then I thought, wait a minute, I can lift my arm from the shoulder and the back of the upper arm, the inside of the elbow. And it's sort of like there's a million ways to lift your arm, right? Yeah. If you think about it, the arms can come from the rib cage or from the sit bones. It depends where you start the journey. So yeah, the how is just opening up possibilities. So yeah. It's like that is much more interesting for me because everyone has their own way of doing that, you know, and I just see it daily. It's, I feel like, oh my gosh, it's a never ending
so story. As you're moving, I mean, I'm just interested because the way you literally just lifted your arm there, you had a whole dialogue going on there. Is that what's happening in your head at the time?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up because I'm also, well, I'm dyslexic.
Okay.
And I didn't really even understand that I was dyslexic until my son had dyslexia and I was coaching him and we took him to the clinic to do all of his to have all of his coaching and all of that. And I was like, wait a minute, I had these same problems. And why was I not picking up stuff even in the ballet companies? I was always slow.
Really?
Yeah, I had I was always the last one to get it and the one working on the side. Like I asked one of my friends that I grew up with and she went through the ballet company with me and I said, how was I as a dancer? And she was like, you never stop working. And I was like,
oh, wow.
And I didn't even realize it. It's like I had no choice.
Yeah.
So, but through that, I think it helped me with the dyslexia. So that brings me to like talking to the body parts. So the ball gets me started, but then I just start talking to my body parts.
Yeah.
If I feel like I'm using one part too much, you know, if I'm leading from the arms too much, I'll just say, no, just go to the throat or past two different parts of the body. So I just keep talking to the body.
So it's a way of kind of remembering things
as
well.
And that helps me remember. Exactly. That's the point. And I also was very, I can't remember what we're talking about. but that brings me to, not being able to, coming from improvisation and going to setting material, I couldn't really remember. So I had to really break it down, talk to the parts. So the sit bone rotates the leg and the right side of the rib cage softens before I lift the other side of the arm or something. So I would keep giving myself these tasks and then I would repeat it and then I could do it and I could go then deeper into the quality. So that helped me remember. Yeah.
And then I guess at the same time, like, I can imagine it brings a real articulation to what you're doing because you're so informed and so on top of mm-hmm. where things are starting and ending and the kind of journey that you're going through. So, I mean, it sounds as if it kind of filters into your choreographic work as well.
Yeah.
Like into your choreographic brain as you're doing the stream.
Yeah, it does. I mean, certainly. I mean, I also when I work with people, I love that the ideas that I share translate differently into every body. So if I give a phrase of movement, I let them sort of reshape it and rework it in their own way. Because I feel like, God, we're all so different, you know, like we have this history, we have our own ideas, and I'd much rather see how someone else would interpret it than, you know, me telling them exactly what to do. I've done that in the past and it's just been frustrating.
Yeah.
I think for both sides, I just felt like, no, wait a minute, give them. So the tasks I give actually give an aesthetic that I like.
Yeah.
So I know I can.
It pushes it in the direction.
Yeah, it pushes it in a certain direction. And now I know through that I can get sort of like in a way everybody's happy. So they feel like they're a part. And it's really important to have this exchange.
Yeah.
And this, like we were talked about before, this empowerment to create a good atmosphere that everybody feels they're a part of it. And everybody has that, the ability to create. It's just like listening to the body. So
like, we're obviously talking a lot about Streamflow for dancers in particular, but it's also accessible for anyone and everyone, isn't it? Like, it can be beneficial for everybody. I mean, can you talk about that?
Yeah, I remember, when was it? In 2014, I was in Seoul in Korea, and I was part of a festival there. I'd made a solo for a Korean dancer, and then we gave a workshop. And then a director from a theater company asked if he could bring the actors. So it was an amazing experience, because the dancers there had like a certain style, a certain aesthetic.
Yeah.
Like very much approaching the movement from the outside. But the actors that through the tasks, I mean, they have that ability to go in also when they need to change their identity or character, you know, as their act. And it was so touching to see the quality that came out of them and how they could just get into the functional body that the dancers, some of the dancers couldn't believe that they were not, that the actors were not dancers.
Yeah.
It came from such a pure place. And I think it was a wake-up call in a way. Not, I mean, for me as well, like, which I was like, oh my God, it's effective. In the sense of that it can touch people, you know? So it's just like this, so that brought me to the idea of also doing it also with non-dancers, you know, and I would like to do more of that, actually, because also for people who are in like mindfulness and doing the body scan, and for me it's a moving body scan, so
absolutely,
rather than just the imagery and thinking about those things, bring movement to it.
Yeah.
And it is such a lovely way just to get the body moving and get the circulation going, especially these days, you know, with lots of sitting and computers. And
absolutely. The technology overload. But do you have any kind of hopes or ambitions for where you want Streamflow to go? Like what's next for it?
Yeah, I do, actually, because it's like I love it so much. It also, because it feels good to my body and the aging body. I feel like I can just keep going. I get more and more connected to the body. And sometimes my students are like, how'd you do that? And I was like, lots of research and thinking about where things are coming from. So it can be impressive, no? But it's only because I know where it's coming from. And of course, I'm doing this all the time. So it's easier for me, you know, in a way to move in the way that I'm...
You also have a very, very kinesthetically intelligent body, Heidi. Let's not pretend as well.
I mean, I don't know. After all the years of all the different things, I thought, oh, God, at least, okay, that's a good thing. It's nice to hear. But yeah, so after the many years of teaching, and also I'm working together with two dancers in Amsterdam that I've known for 8 years now, Luca and Shai, and we are also developing a bit together. And it's dancers where that I meet in different companies, or people that want to transition into teaching are asking me, are you going to do any sort of certification program, something like that? And I thought, oh, okay, well, of course, first you want it to make sure it's effective and that people are enjoying it.
Yeah.
And now teaching it in the different companies, and they're actually asking for it.
Yeah.
So I felt, okay, this is maybe a good beginning to sort of work towards something. Is this, what could this be, you know, as to sort of build up a certification program? And yeah, I would love to have the time to do that and to work with people in exchange, and just to even have first a long research period to sort of develop a kind of syllabus.
Yeah.
You know, and that what is effective and what are the important things, and bouncing off a group of people.
Yeah.
And then actually having the time away from guest teaching or just even at the school, so I could focus on that alone. Because I noticed that when I do it in concentrated periods of time, it just starts to, things just start to happen and possibility. But it's more like, how do you narrow it down?
Yeah,
because otherwise you go on and on and on and on. So, but yeah, that would be something that I'd love to do. And I also love, so that's one side. So that is keeping on developing the Streamflow and allowing other people to teach it, you know, and to working with, I like working with, with interdisciplinary projects. So working with other artists and how the functional body can contribute to their work and vice versa, how the information of how they work sort of affects the body. So those are things that I, you know, I'm doing, like the project I was saying that I'm doing now.
With a textile designer.
And I also worked with a textile designer that was working with these sensors that you wear on the arm that pick up muscle contraction.
Oh, wow.
So if you tense the arm, the readout on the screen would be more dense. And if you touch someone lightly, it's a bit softer. So I built a duet with Luca and Shai, and they were wearing the sensors. And I would say, okay, use more force or less force. And the textile designer was also giving them information, like, can you go faster?
Oh,
so to create a quicker design, you know? So it was those kinds of things really excite me.
Yeah, for sure.
Because you're getting information, and I love design. I think if I would have had another study, I think I would have gone into...
Yeah.
I never had it when actually it was just dance. So, but if I would had another education, I would have loved to study design. But yeah, so those are the things, the stream flow development, and then these interdisciplinary projects. Yeah.
You had a very lengthy, successful dance career. I just, like, what's the secret to that? I mean, how did you manage to sustain that? Like, what's your secret to longevity in this field?
Oh, I guess it's just curiosity.
Yeah.
And this, I don't know, this desire to learn, to, I think that's the great thing that I could say that came out of the ballet career. I mean, I can say a lot about it, but which was really hardcore and difficult. But I can say it's like something about the work ethic and the drive. And it was very competitive in the States. You know,
I can imagine.
Yeah, it was a different situation. Everything's privately funded, so you want to hang on to your work. And so, but that work ethic, you know, it just made me also... want to explore more.
If we go back to classical ballet, since that's your, I would call, foundation, like, because it's a pretty hardcore technique, do you feel like there's a period in your career where you were almost trying to erase your technique?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I was trying to let it go. So it was, and that we did with Bill a lot. He's like, forget what you, and try to forget what you know. Because he said when he hired me, he's like, I don't want to hire any ballerinas that are afraid of losing their technique. And I was like, first of all, it's like, don't call me a ballerina.
I work so hard at my tendies.
Because I think someone from the company saw me do one of his pieces, Herman Schmerman, which is this pas de deux on point.
Yes.
And I did that, and it was bringing back the ballet. And I only could have ever done that because I had all the other information. When I was in the ballet company, I was very weak. I was not grounded. I was, you know, you're wearing point shoes. I didn't feel the floor.
Yeah.
I had to file my shoes down have bare feet in my shoes so that I could grip and feel, not grip, but expand more of the foot. But I can say still the information that it gave my body is incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm grateful.
Yeah.
That's what I loved about Bill was like working with him in the sense that he would, like, you know, if you would risk something and you would fall because you went for it, he'd be like, now you're dancing.
Yeah.
Now something's happening. So you're forced to go a little bit beyond. And that really took me out of my box, you know, in a way. And already of having done some of his work before I even joined the company, it was just...
Where did you meet William Forsythe?
Yeah, when I first came to Nuremberg, there were a bunch of groupies drive down to Frankfurt, over to Frankfurt, and go and see the performances. No, so from that moment on, I remember we arrived late at the performance, and we had come in, and they were doing this piece called Eidostelos.
Yeah.
And it's a moment that you have this wire that's strung tightly across the stage, and the dancers were just, they were still but alive. It was their backs facing the audience, and I could feel such a tension.
Wow.
And I walked in and I goes, what is this? I mean, I got like goosebumps all over my body. I was just like, there was a listening going on. And I don't know, maybe they had, well, no, because I did Eidostelos. So I was thinking of getting information from him, you know, via the stage manager or getting cues from other people. So there's this, you are so ready and alive and waiting for every. So from that moment on, I started seeing the performances whenever I could. And I had met him then through other dancers. I think it was like after a, I mean, one of the performances that we were having a drink and he was there and I was super
nervous.
Hi, I'm Heidi. And in fact, well, he didn't like it when people were sort of intimidated by him. Yeah. He also gets nervous in front of people, he would say. Sometimes he didn't like walking to a room of people. So he's also very sensitive.
And, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so I met him there and then I ended up auditioning because Anders Hellström, who was my director in Gothenburg, he was leaving and I enjoyed working with him so much that I thought, oh, where am I going to go? And then a friend of mine said, I'm going to audition for Foresight on the weekend. And I was like, oh, no way. You know, and I was 35 and I was like, no, oh my God, I'm going to ask her if I can go with her, you know, because it was a bit delicate.
Yeah, of course.
So then we both went and then I ended up auditioning.
Did she get the job or did you get the job?
Oh, I got the job. It was so
I'd like to talk a bit about some of the valuable lessons that maybe you got from working with William Forsythe. Mm. I've read somewhere that you say that Forsythe taught you to be your own source of movement.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, that was through like trusting, trusting that we have it if we engage with the body in a certain way. Because sometimes he would give a task and I was like trying to do exactly what he said and I wasn't getting anywhere. He wasn't interested, you know. You know, usually you'd say, hey, what's going on over there? What are you doing? And so I hit that wall many times and I was like, wait a second. I mean, I was trying to be loyal.
Yeah.
Because we're told, you know, you're told what to do and you do it kind of thing. And then And as soon as I, you know, I could feel that there was no interest in what I was doing, I was like, you know, the hell with it. I'm going to start to bring in my own ideas. And, you
which
know.
Which is what he likes, right? Because he talks about, like, exercising their right as artists to decide. And
yes, exactly.
Wanting the dancers to be able to say something. Like, he very much respects that desire
yes.
in all of his performers.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. And then we realized, okay, we're all there for a reason. Oh, there was something that he wanted from us as well. So whenever I would go off the task, and so I was like, well, wait, I'm gonna try it this way or something. He'd be like, hey, what are you doing over there? Can you show me or can you teach me? Or, you know? So he was so curious to learn from us in a way. So, I mean, that was amazing. Because I asked him once, because I was feeling like I wasn't finding my way in the company at a certain point. Like, oh, I said, everybody in the, you know, dancers that had worked with him for a long time, I was like, they sort of have this, not a character, or they have their role in the company. And then he looked at me, goes, no, they're just themselves.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, yeah. I was like, oh, Jesus, who am I trying to be? You know, it's like trusting that we are enough, you know, that we are there, like I said, for a reason.
Yeah.
And then he trusts that we will find our way, you know, and that was just, that kind of blew me away.
Do you have a particular favorite piece of work that you danced with him?
Yeah, I would say, oh gosh, I love doing Ido Stelos. That was an incredible, I mean, there's so many masterpieces. But I would have to say I got to do Christina Burkle's part in Loss of Small Detail, which starts with Second Detail.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I would have to say it was Loss of Small Detail. I danced Christina Burkle's part. Second Detail was the first part that was on point, and then Loss of Small Detail is the piece that has the snow falling.
It's absolutely beautiful. I know this
one. Do you know it?
Yeah.
I had seen it years before, and I just thought, God.
She's stunning, Christian Berg.
Yeah, and it was just, I felt so fortunate to be able to learn some of her things. And the nice thing with Bill is that he let us then do it in our own way.
Yeah.
So it was then passing it on, learning from that person, but then finding it for yourself. And I think that was a beautiful process. So she had a lot of text.
Yeah.
And I was very nervous. So I had to speak in German. It's like, zu einen festgelegten Zeit.
It's still there.
Werden wir ein Ereignis beobachtet haben. Oder?
Wow. Yeah,
so it was like, and I had to, you know, I finally got to speak. And then there's this moment where David Kern is, he's this tall, skinny guy that has the black spots on him. Mm-hmm. So he's naked and he's standing on a chair on the stage, the enormous stage, you know, is completely open. You hear the snow falling because the floor is mic'd. And then I had this solo in the snow, and I could slide through the snow, and I was
beautiful.
Just, and I kept, yeah, I don't know. It was something about every time it's like, I can't believe I'm out here doing this, of just trying to take as much as I could from that moment. So lots of small detail. Yeah, that was, yeah.
It's amazing because all of the ex-descendants of Forsyth, you all have this incredibly strong artistic integrity. Where do you think that curiosity and hunger to soak up information comes from? Like, was that something that just happened in the space?
Yeah, I think it was also, you know, it was, I mean, in a way, it was contagious because Bill was so curious constantly, you know? So it encouraged us as well. It's like to learn from everything and everyone. Mm. And I agree with you. If I think of my colleagues that are out there working, like, you know, Amy, you just worked with her.
Yeah.
She was here and she's bringing in this stuff from Akira Hino.
Yeah.
And so he touched us all with his Budo work. I mean, it was mind-blowing for many of us. And then now I'm also working, I'm assisting a choreographer, Yanis Mantefunis, who was also in the company, and he's bringing a lot of those ideas into his work. And yeah, you see everyone, Amanthio, here, and Georg, and all the people that are out there, also Prue in Australia. And so it's so nice to follow and to see, it's like, oh, you can see what touched everyone, and everybody took different elements. And it's like the things that touched us as individuals that we were passionate about.
Yeah.
And I think those are the things that we bring across. And it's, I love to hear what everybody's up to, you know, and to share and see and...
It must be really nice also to know that you kind of belong to that community, that family in a way.
Yeah, even though we're all living in different parts of the world.
Yeah,
so now with, you know, with Yanis being there, I realized like, oh God, it's like a coming home. It's like, I mean, he was 19 when we met and he joined the company in Gothenburg. And I was, I think, 30 at the time. And now, you know, we're meeting again. We danced together at the Forsyth Company as well. And then we didn't see each other for many years. I mean, it's been so wonderful to share and to see a lot of the ideas connect as well. It's like, oh, you took that as well.
Yeah.
Oh, now you're developing it this way. Yeah. So,
You just touched on it now, but, I'm curious to talk a little bit about Akira Hino because that's also maybe a profound or a strong influence that maybe is felt its way into Streamflow as well. Can you talk a little bit about that meeting?
Yeah, that meeting. So I normally do the warm-up that goes through the sections of the body. That is sort of the base of the Streamflow stuff. And then when I give the workshops, I bring in some of the ideas of the touch exercises we did with Hino. So there was an exercise that we would do where we're standing behind the person and the hands are wrapped, our hands are wrapped around the upper arm of the person in front of us, also the back to us. So, and you just shift the arm up and down very gently, as light as possible, just to give direction.
Yeah.
And it was just the moment that your skin fills up in the skin of the other person and a slight shift. It was so delicate, but it's like it caused such a heightened sort of listening situation. And I realized that, well, a lot of us got quite emotional because we realized we had all had careers in like rep companies doing different kinds of work. And it's like, oh, I could have gone so much deeper into the partnering. It's like the moment that you touch, you feel, and then you move. So I think that was the thing that touched me the most. And also the idea of following one thing, like you place your hand underneath the hand of someone else and giving direction from the hand creates extreme physical situations for the person you're working with. So you help them actually organize their bodies by leading them. So a lot of those then exercises I took and sort of adapted it to the Streamflow ideas, as well as placing the hand on different parts of the body that we're not used to using, like the ear, the cheek, the throat, the back of the neck. And so placing on the body parts that we were just working on with the visualization. And then that people really respond well to touch.
Yeah.
But there's that moment that you touch, and then the moment that you feel, and then you go, rather than just touch and go.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's that millisecond, that second in between that gives such a quality to
the
movement.
Super sensitive.
Super sensitive, yeah.
Almost training where you're putting your focus and your awareness. So nowadays you're teaching in many different contexts. So you're teaching both in professional companies and you're teaching in schools. Is there a difference in sharing the Streamflow movement method in those various contexts, or is it?
Yeah, there is in a sense. It depends, you know, of course it depends on the class, the age, the experience. More explanation is needed now for the students, I think. Mm. Most companies that I teach with can access it rather quickly. I feel that there is. So I've noticed like some dancers and companies saying it's like, oh, it's a moment. The class is a moment that I can sort of reconnect to my body.
Yeah.
So just to have a moment to explore for myself.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. So, I kind of let them just go. And it's like with you guys, it's the same thing, no? When I teach this, it's just that you just go off on your thing. And it's like, I don't really need to, you know, you're doing it yourselves. You're just connecting to the parts that you need or you want to explore. So, and it's much quicker. Yeah, it's much quicker with the company dancers, I think.
I'm curious because obviously, like, we're living in a bit of a scary state right now with this COVID pandemic. And I think a lot about the dancers that are graduating, because it's quite a tough time to be coming out of school when there's not much work out there.
And it's hardcore.
Do you have any kind of like advice or for people that are entering
the industry? I would say take advantage of this time in the sense that you can if there's so much available online.
Yeah.
No, there are so many classes that you can do and try. And of course, it's difficult from your living room or your dorm room or something like this, but a lot of my students have also been reconnecting or just connecting to new methods.
Yeah.
You know, because they have the time to do that. So it's nice to hear what's happening and to trust that time that you take to research for yourself can also give you something, in the future. And I've come across so many dancers in that situation and especially finishing school, and wondering, where are things going?
Yeah. What's the best advice you've been given since you've just given some advice?
Yeah, I think I mentioned it already. It was when Bill said to me, it's like, be open to everything.
Yeah.
Be open to all, you know, forms of movement or experiences and let that add to your resource. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where that came from. And so I was just like, wow, you know, it's like it's not my way or the highway. It's just like, ooh, how can that information influence my body? And it's just the bigger the resource, the more, let's say, versatile you are. And also, I think that was something that really touched me.
I want to move on to a little bit about your choreographic work. I mean, it'd be nice to know, like, what do you like to create or what do you like to see in your eyeline when you're creating?
Yeah, first of all, it is I like that I can take them through a process, a warm-up to get more connected to the body. And that's always the starting point because it is, like I said, I will not give, you know, long phrases of movement unless they can take those and then adapt it themselves.
Yeah.
But I do, you know, that's sort of the fundamental, you know, it's the beginning point. So, right. So it's starting with that and then seeing how the ideas resonate in their bodies and how what they come up with. And that's sort of what creates somehow the movement also creates a certain character or something. Mm-hmm. And so then I start to build from there. It's not like I go in and say, okay, this is the piece. Okay, I have an idea. Like I have a theme now of the piece I want to do in Boros, but I'm going to, and the different mediums I'll be working with, you know, and that will also influence the way they work and the choices they make. So that's what I love is to see them bring themselves into the ideas. And like I said, working with another discipline that also influences and gives another layer. So I like that. And I also do prefer not to have the performances in a theater. I like to work in other spaces because I also like to see how the space influences how we work. So I've done that a lot with Luke Anshai, taking material and working in other spaces. So that is, And also it makes it more accessible to other people. So if people say, oh, we're going to the theater to see a performance, or like, hey, we're going to this, you know, there's this really cool design house in Amsterdam yeah. called Hotel Droog, and they have all this, this great space that we explored. And then there was a restaurant there, so people could come and see a bit of the performance of us working with the design objects and then have a drink, you know, and have some food.
I guess so, by doing that, you'll be reaching other kinds of audiences as
and
well.
Yeah, and I do, and that, yeah, that, that's, I think, what's important to me is not only touch a dance crowd.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been surrounded with that for years. And I'm so, it would be so nice to touch other people and, and so that they, you know, become curious about dance through that. So,
I mean, are there particular qualities that you're drawn to in performers? Like, what do you like to see in the performers?
Yeah, you.
Oh, that was very kind.
No, but I remember when you took one of my workshops also, it's like, is like the awareness you had in your body and how articulated it is, and you know, how quickly you would respond to ideas is very sensitive. And I think that is what's very touching to me. You know, I think it is, the importance that's given to each part. Yeah, I love a highly articulated body, not meaning that it always has to be that way, but a very sensitive body. Yeah.
Do you like, do you think back and do you miss performing on stage yourself?
No.
Interesting.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. You feel satisfied and content.
Oh yeah. I don't miss it. Performing was always that gave me such a stress before the, I mean, I was a bit, you know, feeling a bit nauseous before, but I was really a process dancer. I love the process.
Yeah.
It's like an education, you know.
I totally relate to that.
You know, I just felt like, oh, I love the research.
Yeah.
I love that I'm developing, and then somehow something about being on stage, it took away a certain layer of deepness. Now somehow I felt like I could go deeper into the body. Yeah. So no, I don't miss being a performer. I don't. People have asked me, it's like, why are you not performing? And it's like, I just... But why? I mean, I'd rather be behind the scenes or working with dancers, giving information, or it's just...
And it feels like you're getting that satisfaction through working and engaging with other people and drawing out of them.
It is so satisfying. I feel so lucky in a sense that it's like when I see someone discover a new part of the body that they haven't experienced before, I was like... That is huge. Take that with you for the day. I would say if you leave the room with one new idea, it's enormous.
Yeah.
And then they'll stack up.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, we're going to do a little bit of a quick fire round just for fun. We're going to lighten
things. Oh, no.
So we're just gonna, I'm going to blast through some questions. And you kind of have to just go with the first thing that comes to your head. Now, if you need like a couple of seconds to wait, think, fine. But we'll try and keep the tempo up.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I'm going to start with question one. So question one is, what's the piece of work that is most vivid that you might still dance in your dreams when you close your eyes?
That would be loss of small detail.
What's something that people often get wrong about you?
Oh, gosh, I'm going to have to wait on that one. Wrong about me.
It's tricky because you're such a positive person. Always just so nice. I think you have this reputation.
They think that there's a certain amount of innocence.
Ah, that's a good answer. Okay, question three, Lycra. Do you love it or hate it?
Hate it.
Number four, what are you thinking about when you're dancing?
What I'm feeling.
Excellent. Number five, biggest change in dance since your career started that's positive?
The influence of somatic work.
Biggest change in dance since your career that's slightly negative since you started?
Lack of work ethic in students.
Your profession means that you must travel a lot, obviously. So what's your guilty pleasure at an airport?
Sushi.
Very nice. When you're away, because you're often away, what do you miss most about home?
Oh, my son and my boyfriend, I'll have to add.
People should watch dance because?
It might move them.
Did you have any pre-show rituals?
Yes, I used to always try to do some abdominals to get connected to the core.
Core. The best is past or the best is yet to come?
Yet to come.
What's the piece of music that never fails to make you want to move?
Anything from Radiohead.
Favorite book or a book that you're currently reading?
Reading Collective Genius.
Collective Genius. Okay, I'll have to Google that.
Yeah.
Give us a snapshot of ordinary moment in your life that brings you great joy.
Biking with my son to the skate park.
What's the one thing that you're deeply grateful for right now?
Everything that's taken me to this point.
Vulnerability is, you have to complete the sentence, vulnerability is.
Being able to let go.
And then the last one is, connection is.
Communication.
Excellent. You survived.
Oh my God. But I'll probably think about it and go, oh no.
Wonderful. Well, Heidi, it's been an absolute pleasure.
I survived.
You survived. No, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity. No, I really enjoyed it. So it also helped me to reflect on my life.
No, but thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you as well.
So for people who would like to find out more about Heidi and the Streamflow Method, you can check out her website at heidiviatala.com, or you can find her on Facebook and Instagram. So now we move on to a Streamflow movement exploration led by Heidi for you to try at home. Just have a little check of your surroundings, make sure you've got a bit of space to move, and you can join in seated or standing. And just a little note that this one is slightly longer than normal, so give yourself a good 30 minutes to practice. Over to you, Heidi.
Looking forward to guiding you through this now. So you can either sit comfortably in your chair, or if you're standing, stand with the feet parallel, just about hips width apart. And think of, if you're standing, softening your knees. So you're just, you keep your knees available and relax your shoulders. And soften your neck. I'll talk a lot about releasing your jaw. So if you're sitting as well, see if you can keep your spine alive and soft like a child's spine. And also let's just start to take a few deep breaths. So we're just going to inhale. And as you exhale, try to sort of soften through the body. So you're just letting out any tension that you might have. And again, inhale and exhale, and think of sort of softening the jaw and the neck, the shoulder space, breathing through the body. So I'm going to bring in the imagery that I was talking about earlier about following the image of a ball moving in between both eyes. So we're just going to focus on the space between your eyes. And sometimes it helps with the imagery to keep the eyes closed. So see what happens. There's also the tendency to get a little bit nauseous because a lot of people aren't used to putting the head in motion so much. Even for dancers at times, it's a bit yeah, it can cause a bit of dizziness or nausea. But you can just take it easy in the beginning. So thinking of the image of a ball rolling in between both eyes. So just let the ball roll. So inside the head, like from eye to eye, and notice how the head just starts to gently shift in the space. And you'll notice that when you send the ball in the eye space, it slightly shifts the neck, and then the shoulder space might move a bit. So just let that happen and keep letting the tension out the shoulders and the jaw. So you can also explore the eye sockets. So if you imagine the ball rolling around the eye sockets, how does that shift the head? A bit differently. And as you're shifting from side to side, see if you can keep letting the tension go out of the jaw. So relax the jaw. Soften the neck space. Right. You can think of the ball of sort of gently tapping the back of the eye, and that might just easily turn your head. Or it's just tapping an eye from the top of the eye, and you feel your chin lowering, and what happens if you release your jaw and soften your neck more. So the ball can also pick up the head from the eye space. You can pick up and pick, just choose an eye, maybe. Right. So see now, we can play a little bit with, so there's different things you can do. You can add a little bit of weight to the ball so it can be a little bit playful in the sense that maybe it's a little bit heavier or maybe it's very light, like a ping pong ball. So just gently shifting in the eye space. So it can also inflate in one of the eyes, sort of lifting up the head gently from the eye space. And then what happens when you start to deflate that? So it just softens down. Other possibilities are maybe rolling the ball from the back of the eye to the front of the eye. Does that tip the head forward? Or if you roll from the front of the eye to the back of the eye, so just see if you feel the difference and notice how it's the rest of the body is sort of organizing itself around the ball leading you in the eye space. So now I'm going to go a little bit further with this and think about how you could travel within the head space and try to get from eye to eye. So everything is possible. What happens if you roll ball to the back of the head? Does that shift the weight on your feet? Or does it shift you in the chair that you're sitting in? So you can think of the back of the head like a sort of a skateboard ramp. So it's rolling along the back of the head. And then how does it find its way back to the other eye? Right. You can let it roll down to your chin and see what that does. And go back up to the other eye. It might pick up the eye. And just letting it roll along the inside of the forehead to the back of the head and then finding its way back to the eye somehow. Right, so all of this is already leading the body gently in the space. So if you tend to get a bit dizzy, you can also try this with your eyes open. So it's up to you to explore a little bit. So if you're standing and you want to change your levels, you can make the ball a bit heavier. So see how that might lower the head and then how the rest of the body follows through. So the weight of the ball could take the head and the neck and the shoulder space, and then maybe you sort of melt down and soften through the rest of the body so you can see how far that goes, right? And then if you want to, once you've lowered yourself down, you can pick your head up from the eye space and see just what you notice. Another idea is just letting the ball sort of soften the eyes. So just, we have a lot of tension and stress in the eyes. Let's see if you can just soften the eye space. And once again, trying to let go of places where you have tension, like the jaw, the neck space, the shoulder space, while you're leading with the eye space. So you'll get a little bit deeper pathways in the body. So now we're going to move on a little bit. Still initiations from the head, but you're going to try to find a way to let the ball roll from your eye space to one of your ears. So just take a moment to find a pathway. What would that be? Maybe it rolls along the inside of the cheekbone, softens the bone, and finds its way to the ear canal. We've all probably had water in our ears, so you can think of water streaming or the ball rolling in the ear canal. And what happens if the ball rolls from the back of the ear to the front of the ear, or gently tries to sort of come out of the ear, so it's sort of pulling your head from the ear? Right. Now, once again, you can play a little bit with the weight of it. So it can be heavy to take you down, and then it can float up and inflate like a balloon. Or it can be very light and sort of just gently tapping in the ear, bouncing like a ping pong ball. So it, and then see now how you could get from ear to ear. So I might just let it pass from one ear to the other, straight across the center of my head, which might shift the weight on my feet or shift the weight on my sit bones if I'm sitting. So feeling the ear sort of pulling the neck and pulling the shoulder space. So, right. Feeling the weight of it taking you down from the ear space. Right, so you can let it roll along the back of the head to the other ear. And as you roll along the back of the head, you can think of softening the back of the skull. So it's sort of softening. And again, you can always bring in the release of the jaw. Softening of the neck and the shoulders if you're standing. Softening the knees as well. Right, or you can gently toss it from one ear to the other ear, like in the, along the front of the face, softening the muscles in the face and trying to get to the other ear, right? Or places where you have tension along the forehead, in between the eyes, and then to the other ear. Right, I always think of the ball as a bit warmer, so it sort of softens the muscles or picks up parts of the head from inside. Yeah, so it suspends somewhere from inside, and then just keep finding your way back to the ear. Toss it along the top of the head gently so that it lands in the other ear. Right, and then the weight, always changing the weight of the ball can help you lower yourself from the ear space. Even if it makes you lean over the side of the chair or pulls you to the back of the chair or almost pulls you up out of your seat from the ear space or changes your levels if you're standing. Now I'm going to suggest that you think of your ears as your eyes. So try to remove your vision if you can. So and either close your eyes or just put your focus on your ears seeing. So try to see the space that you're in with your ears. It could be that you've the first time you've walked into this space, since you're familiar with it, now try to come in again for the first time. So I might want to see things that are in front of me with one ear or next to me. Beside, yeah, so beside you, next to you, below you. What's, yeah, so it allows you to change your levels from the ears. Trying to see things in the room, like whether it's your bookshelf or your kitchen sink or where you are in your living room. I just want to change my levels, trying to see the carpet on the floor or the corners of the sofa or trying to see something out the window. Right, and it can gently also pull you towards something. So for dancers, it's also nice that you leading with the ears gives you more unpredictable head directions. So you start to lead basically with the side of your head. So yeah, and then so too. So you have that. So with now I'm trying to see the space. So it's pulling me out into the space from my ears. So taking my body out or shifting me more around the chair. Now try to see parts of your own body with your ears. So the difficulty might feel that it's not possible. But if you try to see your belly button with your ear, it just lowers the head down. And so as soon as you feel that the body stops, see if you can let go of tension somewhere to follow through with what you want to see. Right. So I could try to see my belly button. The other ear can pull me up, and I could try to see my shoulder blade with my ear. It may feel impossible, but it just takes you in a direction. And as you start to see these things, just keep following through by softening the rest of the body. So I could try to see the sections of my arm, or try to see my belly button, or try to see the thighs or the inside of my knee. Yeah, so just helps you to fold into the body. And I kind of feel that it also stretches and gives space in the vertebra. So see what you can find. And if you feel you get to a point where you get stuck, just soften that area. You always start with the jaw, the throat softening, the shoulder space, or softening through the legs if you need them to let you lower. So softening the thighs, feeling the weight of the pelvis. Right, so you can play a little bit with seeing things far away, and then so maybe one ear is seeing something far away and the other one wants to see something close to the body. So you have a little bit of a game going on. It's like which one wins, or interruptions, like one ear wants to go out, the other one wants to go into the body. So you keep shifting the directions. Yeah, great. So that's just a little taste of the headspace. So you can always bring in your ideas, and I usually talk through the class, so I always open for people to bring in their ideas. I think that's so important. We're going to swallow the ball now, going on to the neck space. So imagine that it's rolling around in your neck space. And here I really think of the ball as being a bit bigger and even warmer, so you can add... Yeah, let the temperature go up a little bit. So there's usually a lot of tension in the neck. So I'm just slowly exploring the neck space. If you're standing, try to keep the knees soft and relax your jaw so that you can get into that area a bit easier, so it's a little bit more accessible. Relax the shoulders. And then just playing with simple... just directions coming out of the neck. It's as if the ball is gently pressing out of the neck space. So if it's pressing out of just pulling me from the side of the neck, so that could lead my head before my ear goes somewhere. So I can think it comes out the side, and then the neck or the head shifts, and then so you have a deeper initiation point of the head. Another image I like is the idea of the ball has these superpowers, so it can be playful. So in a way, you could let the ball roll along the side of the neck, and it just softens the neck and softens the muscles, and that might just be enough to move the head, right? So just going along the side of the neck, then you feel the weight of the head. Thinking of moving first from your throat. So if it pulls out of my throat, I might feel my chin come later and then feel the weight of the head going down. If my head is hanging down, I might want to pull it up from the back of the neck and then feel it, the journey through the vertebra all the way to the top of the head and then leading with the head, right? Right, and just a reminder to keep releasing the jaw. You can also tense it to feel that the difference of when you tense the jaw and when you release the jaw. So just to see. Right. Yeah, nice. So seeing with all the parts I'm talking about you can use to see the space. So if I try to see the ceiling with the side of my neck, that might send my body in a curve.
Right.
Or try to see my own body with the neck space also gives a bit of length. I want to see what's over on the other side of my chair, on the floor, but I'm going to lead with the neck space. And then feel the head move later. So yeah, really initiating from the neck space. And then you can play with maybe the left side of my neck is softening and the right side of my neck wants to go somewhere else. So you have my throat is melting, but the back of my neck pulls me into the back space. Yeah, good. So these are just a few ideas for the neck space, and we'll travel on down now, working our way into the upper chest and rolling along the collarbone. A lot of times I place my hand on the collarbone and sort of let it slide down into my shoulder, to the shoulder space. So as soon as you feel that journey from the collarbone softening and landing in the shoulder joint, try to release that arm. So immediately that arm is passive, so it's asleep. So I want to feel the weight of the bones. Now I'm just going to explore that shoulder joint. Simple things, like if I lift my arm from just the shoulder, and as I lift my arm, I'm going to release my as I lift my arm from the shoulder, I'm going to release the arm even more so I feel the weight of it. So I'm not leading with the arm at all. So you can think of lifting the hand from the shoulder. And what happens if you open the shoulder into the back space? Does it take your arm behind you? Right, so you just lead from the back of the shoulder. And then the front of the shoulder, the inside of the shoulder, that can also pull your hand, pull your arm around. So not moving from the hands or the rest of the arm, but really leading from the shoulder. You can feel the weight in the shoulder taking the hand down or pulling the hand back up. Also, if you release the arm, just gently try to toss it. Toss the arm from the shoulder space. So you can toss it across the body and then feel the weight of the hand falling or the weight of the arm, the weight of the bones falling, and try to follow through with that falling motion. So just gently tossing the arm up from the shoulder space and then releasing it and seeing where that takes you. Where do you stop? Does it stop in the legs or... Yeah. Right. So another nice thing is to lift the shoulder, open it to the back space. And if you do that with both, so if you want to get into the other shoulder, that's also fine. So let it sort of the ball roll along the upper back. And now you've got that space in between the shoulders, both collarbones softening, the upper back softening. And now both arms are released and just moving from the shoulder space. Right. So maybe one is lifting up, the other is melting down. Maybe one is folding in and rotating, and the other one is opening and taking the arm behind you. To open the chest area, you can think of the shoulders rotating open, rotating to the back, and it takes your arms behind you, and you feel that opening in the chest. And then taking the hands in front of you again by bringing the shoulders forward, almost sort of folding in. If I send my arm in front of me, just lift it into the space and it's in front of me, I can pull it back from the shoulder space. And then you feel all the sections pulling in, so the upper arm, lower arm, hand, right? Now tilting the shoulder space and letting the arm sort of fall and pour out of the shoulder space as you tip the shoulder space. Tipping sideways, you might feel the arms move one at a time, one and then the other. Right. And if I am standing and I want to go to the floor, I could start just tilting my shoulder space all the way forward and then softening through the rest of the body, and that's a way to take you to the floor. And then see how you might come up. Or if you're sitting in the chair, it takes you over and hanging over your body, and then you come up from the shoulder space. Right. So from the shoulders. So that's just a few ideas of just working with that space. And you can always play a game with all these parts. Of the one shoulder wants to take me into the back space, the other one wants to take me down. So it's a little bit of a game of which direction wins. Right. And then you will notice, hopefully, where are the parts of the body that are a bit have a bit too much tension, or parts that you never usually access. So we'll go from, I'd like to really spend time, just a moment in the armpit. So think now in a way that the ball is underneath the armpit, or that it sort of inflates. Right, so it inflates and it picks up the arm from underneath. It can also take the arm up to the ceiling and sort of rotate. So you really feel a lot of space underneath. So the arm is really starting in the armpit. You can even sit in the chair and start to get space in the armpits and then lift your arms from there. So let's think of this balloon inflating and just picking up from underneath and taking the arms up. Right, and you can even open up the armpit up to the ceiling and rotate the arm from the armpit and see if that gives you more space. For me, it lets out a lot of tension, gets a lot of space there. So see, lifting, rotating, taking the arm down from the armpit, everything, just to see, just a different point. Initiation, so I usually spend a lot of time here, but I think I have to move on. So we go from the shoulder to the elbow. So if I'm going to work in that area, I'm going to try to release my arm from the elbow all the way down to the hand, so I just can shake it out for a moment, so you have a moment to reset and just get into. So I'm just going to think about my upper arm. So again, if you are sitting or standing, you can just adapt it. I mean, there's no right or wrong here. It's more important about not what anything looks like. It's like, what does it feel like? Can that imagery do something to me? So just easy things like the ball just tapping the bones in the upper arm. So it just might take you in a direction. So sometimes I just use my hand to sort of tap my upper arm in directions, and then I just release the lower arm, so it will come. So you can send the upper arm in the space, and you can have delay in your body, or you can try to catch up with it. So, right, tossing it sideways or behind you, and then seeing where it takes you. So tossing from different directions out of the upper arm. Right. So you feel that. Also, a nice imagery, and a lot of this is also trying to use less muscle and effort, is the image of the ball picking up your arm from under the skin. So if I do that, if I pick up my upper arm the ball picks it up from under the skin, there's a delay in my lower arm, and then the hand comes later. So it's like the lower arm is asleep, the upper arm is being lifted, and then the upper arm can also take the lower arm back down. So you can try that a bit in both arms. So what happens if the ball lifts the upper arm, you rotate the arm, and how does that affect the rest of the body? If you lift and rotate, and that affects the shoulder space, and then see where that might take you. So whether you different rotations, so rotating the upper arm inwards or outwards, or lifting. And so this just to start you off with other things that you might find in this. And then you can bring in different dynamics of like a slicing motion. So be careful when if you don't have a lot of space, but sort of this sort of slicing motion that comes from the upper arm, it just gives another dynamic. It's almost like you're cutting your way through the jungle. It's just like a slicing motion. So it gets you a bit more physical. Right, so that can come out different sides of the arms. Yeah. And then you can see also, so you have a slicing motion, but what if you go from a slicing motion and then the arm floats? So slice and float, where one arm is slicing and the other arm is floating. Both are floating, both are slicing, just so you can... Different dynamics, efforts. It's also from the Laban system of the efforts, so it's always been very helpful for me to bring in and make me go deeper into those areas. So slicing, floating, and then you have dabbing, which is where you send the upper arm somewhere and then it bounces back. So it's like a rebound. So it goes vroom, and then it comes back. Yeah, so it's like a reverse moment. So you can do a very easy trip of slicing, floating, and rebounding. So you start to feel different things happening in the body, right? It can also be that one upper arm is very heavy, takes you down, and the other one is just floating up. So, right, a little battle of efforts. And it keeps changing. So that actually starts to organize, if you're standing, your feet in different ways. Right, and the movement can get quite complex in the sense that this one idea helps your body organize itself in complex ways and without really having to think about it. And this is a little, yeah. So we're going to go on from the elbow to the wrist. Yeah. So we're going to, yeah, so the elbow to the wrist. Same thing. Notice where the wrist is, so there's that joint, and then the hand flips over. So think of releasing the hand and now lifting the hand from the lower arm, and at one point the wrist is going to fall over, and then you feel the weight of the hands and see if you can follow through with the weight of the hand as if, yeah, and the rest of the body is going to follow. So picking up the hand from different sides of the lower arm. So yeah. And then eventually you can go to the image of blowing up the hand like a balloon from the wrist, so you expand out through the sections of the hands, and then which part deflates first. So it's almost like if you were going to pump up a tire or something, so you feel it getting tense, almost full of air, and then which part softens first, so I could fill up the hand with air, and then maybe some of the fingers start to soften first, or the palm of the hand, or I blow up my hand in front of me, it starts to pull me in the space, and I pull it back from the elbow or the shoulder. So basically now we've quickly gone through the whole upper octopus. So you should feel, so it's, you can take an easy trip on your own with this now, so you can just take a scan of what we've done and talk I always talk to my body parts in the end, and it just helps me sort of tune in a bit better to where things are coming from. Like I can just say to myself, okay, the space between my eyes, the space between my ears, and how I get there. Swallowing the ball, getting into the next space, finding my way to the space in between my shoulders and my shoulders. And then how I work my way down to the upper arms and how that extends out to the lower arm, the wrist, and the hands. So you can play with any order. And just feel also the tilting, shifting of the shoulders can change your levels. So, and all of these sections can see the space and take you in many different places. So after that, I would normally talk you through the rib cage, the abdominals, the pelvis, and all the sections of the legs, the ankles, and the feet. So then you have the lower octopus as well. So, yeah, I think that's kind of going to round it off now. I hope you enjoyed it and that it took you somewhere or somewhere in your living room or at least helped you to find new places in the body to move from. So, yeah, that's just a small taste, and maybe you can make your own, bring in your own ideas or work on areas that you've never really thought about using or initiating your movement from those places. So keep breathing. And yeah, thank you.
That's it for Dance Pod this week. Head to our website at skånestanstheater.se for more information about upcoming performances and workshops. Why not write to us on social media? Ask us a question or send a video of you dancing. We'd love to hear from you. From all of us here at Skånes Dansteater, thank you so much for listening and catch you next time.